All right, folks, it's been a long old winter, but we are finally going World Cup racing again, and this is your Max's Tyres pre-race show for the opening round of the Downhill World Cup up in Fort William, where I'll be joined by coach to the stars, Chris Kilmurray, to get the inside line on the unique demands of Fort William, and we'll be talking about who we're excited to watch as the race season gets going. Maxis is synonymous with racing and is the name that comes to mind when you think of performance. It's no surprise then that they've won more than any other brand in the history of World Cup racing. No matter where or how you ride, Maxis has the tyres for you with a wide range of tread patterns, casing and compound options. Personally, for me on my enduro bike, I run the DHR2 Max Terra Double Down on the rear, paired with the Assegai Max Grip up front in their slightly lighter XO Plus casing. I find that casing is tough enough for pretty much all the riding I do, especially when it's on the front wheel. The downhill bike, I've got the DHR2 front and rear. They're both the DH casing and the super grippy Max Grip compound. Both those setups are working great for me, but check out the range and see what's going to be good for you. You can check out the entire range of Maxis tyres over at maxis.com and find the tyres at your local Maxis dealer. You can also give them a follow on Instagram where they're at Maxis Bike. All right, racing gets going this weekend in the brutal landscape of the Scottish Highlands. So here is your Maxis Tyres pre-race show for the opening round of the 2024 Downhill World Cup in Fort William, Scotland, with Chris Kilmurray. Chris Kilmurray, welcome back to our first pre-race show of 2024. It's been a long off-season. How you doing?
Good, yeah. It's good to be back. I think it has kind of been a long off-season, but it's also been considerably shorter than last year's off season, because this time last year we were just finished a test event in Lourdes, actually.
Yeah,
so
true.
And we still had like 6 weeks or whatever until the first World Cup, so it's coming around a lot quicker. But I think the general feeling I'm getting from all the riders I coach and all of the riders and general World Cup people I'm friendly with is that everyone is extremely keen.
Yes, I think everyone's ready to go racing. Yeah, so from your experience then, what kind of state are most of the athletes like in at this point in the season? Are they ready to go? Are they anxious? Are they nervous? Are they a bit maybe overhyped for it?
Caged. Some of them are caged animal spec now. They're just ready to go. Some of the more mature and experienced ones are probably just kind of going through the typical motions. I know a few of the riders I coach, last week's training, the kind of final big block before we taper off, had a good blend of, you know, kind of your classic physical training sessions, physiologically focused stuff, that had a bit of, you know, tapering kind of science, you know, increase or, you know, maintaining intensity, reducing volume a bit, that sort of thing. But actually there was a lot of activities and just general, keep me busy, keep my mind off racing for a week. So there was a few more motorbike and motocross rides and games of tennis and climbing or whatever else than we'd normally plan, just because people wanted to be occupied because they are extremely keen. Yeah. And I think we'll probably talk about it later, but how dense and deep all the categories are. I think everyone knows that anything is possible and they could have, you know, the best first World Cup of their life or an absolute disaster that they can kind of need to regroup from. So everyone just wants to get going.
Yeah, it's an exciting proposition for a season. And we kick off in Fort William, which, let's face it, is a bit of a brute of a track for the first round of the year. One of the longest tracks on the circuit. Is that going to be playing on riders' minds?
Yeah, interesting one, because it's definitely a brute. It's an outlier, which we probably talked about when we did the World Champs pre-race podcast last year, in terms of how long it is and how flat it is, and how high the average speed is, really kind of stable for a lot of it. So it's a bit of an outlier compared to some of the other tracks. The resurfacing and all the work they did for World Champs last year makes it faster and a little bit less rough. Obviously, it's degraded since then, but they are working on it kind of even as we speak, I think. So it's definitely an outlier. It's closer to an early 2000s style track than it is to a 2020 style track. But it is still brutal, especially if the weather's bad or if it rains a lot just pre-event and, you know, some of the gravel and dirt that gets added gets washed away quite quickly. Depending on the number of riders you have after a couple of practice sessions, it gets destroyed. So it's definitely an interesting one to start on. But because World Champs was in August last year, it's actually pretty recently that we were racing there, and pretty much everyone and their dog has been there practicing or riding. And I did see people are even riding it yesterday, which is very rare to have the World Cup track open, you know, exactly a week before the World Cup race day. Normally it's closed for 2 or 3 weeks before the event, you know, after the BDS. So this year the BDS is after the World Cup. Teams and riders have been there for test camps and training camps of different kinds. People have just been up just for general days riding. And the World Champs was there last August. So it's only been, you know, 8 or 9 months since we were there last. So generally, yeah, everyone will just know what to expect, I think. And it is a bit of a brute. It's long, it's physical, but they've made some changes to the lower sections, I think, which will make it faster, a touch less physical, even less pedaling again. So yeah, everyone's going to be, this day and age, everyone's pretty much ready, prepared.
Yeah. What do we know about the changes then? You mentioned some stuff going on in the lower part of the track. Do we know much stuff for certain at this point?
Yeah, there was plans, I think, to make some changes up top too, which I'm not sure they're going to happen now from what I can see. So I think the original plan was to start it from the balcony on the restaurant, just to make a bit of a change up, make it a touch shorter, but also just make it a bit more interesting for the spectators. They could access the track from either side without having to cross the track, and just kind of mix things up a bit, and it'd be a good visual for TV and for photographs as well. I'm not sure that's going to happen now. It doesn't look like it will. So the top section, because it got so much work for World Champs, is pretty much going to stay the same. Obviously, we won't know exactly how they tape it, but you can only get creative in terms of a couple of centimeters each side with that, with this track. So it's only when we get to the woods where things change. So there might be some tweaks to the main wood section, which was Sector 3 last year. And then it's below that. So when we get to the Hazard Hoofer, the little river gap, it's from that point onwards, I think, where they've made some big changes. So a new wall ride, where the stump gap, the famous, infamous stump gap used to be, which then kind of sent you down into this bowled out left-hand corner with this cheese grating cattle grid on the exit. That's all straightened out. So you're going to go to riders left of that, do a river jump. So you're just going to carry way more speed out, way less pedaling. So it's just going to be faster and, I think, yeah, less physical in terms of pedaling demands, but just more modern. And the motorway jumps have been reshaped again, because last year they were a little bit kicky and a little bit short, unfortunately, which caused some pretty huge crashes in the first practice session last year. So that's been reshaped, redone, and everyone said that they're still too small, but they're safer than they were. So that's good. And there you go. So I think it'll be, my guess, it'll be 85% the same and maybe, yeah, 15% new.
Yeah. And what's the score of that motorway section? It always seems to have quite a significant impact on the results. And everyone seems to have a slightly different view about what the right way to approach it is, whether it's tucked, whether it's pedaling. Like, I'm guessing getting downside and timing is super important, but it can definitely split a race, eh?
Yeah, it can do. And it could have decided the men's race a bit more last year, but with the weather being the way it was and how well Charlie Hatton rode Sector 2, the main upper rocky slopes, you know, once you get past the boardwalks into that rocky stuff, Charlie just dominated everyone there. If Andy Culp hadn't have made that mistake in the woods, he made a huge mistake in the woods last year, which cost him over a second. He beat Charlie by enough in the motorway that he could have comfortably won the race if it wasn't for that mistake. So I think if everything plays out relatively equal above the motorway can be a deciding factor. For the women last year, for whatever reason, Camille Ballanche decided to not pedal between the jumps. She tucked, and that potentially cost her to win against Valley. Valley was the only sector Valley won last year, was Sector 5, the motorway. So all else being equal, the motorway can decide it. All on its own, it probably doesn't. But there is still, like, yeah, maybe a second and a half to 2 seconds to be had on the motorway between doing a very bad job and a very good job. And like you said, it's backside. It's like that perfect balance of maintaining high speeds with getting backsides and knowing when and how to pedal and where and how to pedal. So, and it's great to go back to the previous footage and analyze it and see who did what. But 2022, 2023, 2024, 3 years in the trot, and we've had three different versions of the motorway. The jumps are in basically the same place, but they've been reshaped each time. Bigger, smaller, steeper, shallower. Kicky, not kicky, boggy, not boggy. So, yeah, I think it's one of the harder ones to analyze at the event. And I think a lot of it is down to rider intuition in the race room. It's that experience and that intuition of exactly how to get both wheels down early enough to get pedaling or to get tucking and not lose any speed. So.
Yeah, fair. Well, let's see what we get this year. Like you say, no British Downhill Series ahead of the World Cup this year. It's sort of been almost a traditional mini World Cup race in previous years. But the track has been open and, like, virtually everyone seems to have been there to some extent. Do you think that's, I guess it's, if it's open, people are going to do it, right? People are going to go up there. And it, like you say, it's a bit of an outlier as a track. So getting a setup and being prepared and ready for it is is actually probably quite a significant advantage, but not everyone's been there. So there's been some people deciding not to make that call.
Yeah, some people deciding not to make the call to go for pre-season testing riding. Are we at a stage now where, because give or take, all of the tracks that we race on, if you can ride on them, so people have been riding Ludenville all winter long because they didn't have much snow lowdown. So all of the tracks that we race on, if you can ride them during the winter, people will. And then the other tracks that we no longer race on that are good, like Luza, for example, people will go and do training and testing camps there. So the question, I suppose, now is, are we at a stage where we need to mandate, regardless of what the local people who run the ski slope or run the ski lift want, are we at a stage where we should mandate, you know, that if you're racing the World Cup in 6 weeks' time, 3 weeks out, you're not allowed to ride the track anymore? I think we are at that stage where it should be mandated, personally, but that's just my opinion. And that's just to keep things as, I don't know if it's fairness or, but it's definitely a battle of resources, a battle of time, and a battle of location as well. Just if you're in South America or Southern California, a quick trip to Fort William is not a quick trip. Whereas if you're in Wales, a quick trip to Fort William is a pretty quick trip. So there's a few bits and bobs there, but like it's open. And from what I understood, Nevis Range wanted to just leave it open so people had tracks to ride. Challenge for them because they were working on it while people were riding, which is always a danger. But you can understand from a revenue point of view, if they want to, you know, make the gondola viable and make money, it is what it is. And we need that gondola. We need that whole infrastructure to be there, to be successful, to host the host races. So it's kind of a bit of give or take really there. And pretty much I imagine that majority of people who've been paying for lift passes on the Nevis Range the last 2 months have been World Cup professionals, so, or aspiring professionals. So it's an interesting one, but everyone's ridden it before. And I think the key thing with Fort William is, you know, if you haven't been there for a pre-season riding or testing, it will only take you a handful of runs to get yourself around, get your head into gear, let's say. And a big portion of that is the peripheral vision. It's the fact that there's no trees. And everywhere else you've been riding all winter probably has some trees. So it's having the level of roughness and technicality and the speed without the peripheral visual information helping you understand what's fast, what's close, where breaking points are, because you use that peripheral vision for so many things without realizing it. And the better you are, the more you use it, will be the general hunch from and the evidence from other sports. So I think if you haven't been there, just take your time. That's the advice I'll be giving the riders I coach who haven't been there for pre-season testing and riding, is that it'll just take a couple of laps. Don't let yourself get dragged around by those who've been there week in, week out, year in, year out, who are up to speed from the second turn, you know, from the second run. So just give it the time.
Yeah. And we're going to be going from here, which is one of the longest tracks on the circuit, to Poland, which is rumoured to be very much on the shorter end of the spectrum. Is it fair to sort of talk about those as a marathon and a sprint? And if so, is like physical preparation and being ready for both of those events so close together a challenge for riders? Or do you see them much closer in terms of like physical demands and the condition you want your body to be in for each one?
I think the riders, especially the top tier riders, will be totally physically conditioned adequately for both tracks. They are definitely different, so they require different in run tactics, maybe slightly different management of your own physical abilities in relation to the technicality of the track, and then that basically helps you decide your tactics if you know what you're doing. From what I understand from the technical director now, Rory Cunningham, who let, you know, some of the coaches who've been helping out with ideas around track safety and track design and that sort of thing, from what I understand from Poland, it's kind of a typical, kind of close to Lenzerheide, slight touch longer than Lenzerheide. And in terms of the size and the shape of the hill, it's quite like Leogang, with the exception of we go straight down as opposed to doing the big long motorway we do in Leogang. So it's kind of it seems like a typical World Cup track, 400 meter descent, 2 kilometers, 2.2 kilometers long or something. So I think it's right on the ballpark. And it's going to be, from what I understand, I've not seen a whole pile of images or photos. I've been checking out on Instagram from the course builders to see if there was anything good on there, but I couldn't see anything. But it just, what I did see, it made me think of Maribor mid-2000s. Just fresh, lots of roots, rocks, fresh dirt. So I think we're in for a treat, I think, yeah. Fingers crossed.
That sounds good. Yeah, definitely, man. And we're pretty early in the calendar for Fort William. It's not unheard of, but it's fairly early. But the current forecast, and I'm going to cross my fingers at this point, looks relatively decent, like limited rain, occasional showers, And not too much wind, which has definitely impacted results in the past, especially on the exposed upper parts of the track. It's looking pretty spot on, I think, because a bit of rain's good for Fort William, right?
Yeah, I was actually talking to some of the younger riders I coach who have only just kind of come out of the World Cup scene since kind of COVID era. And they had no idea we had like a 2017 World Cup, or maybe even 18, where we had like 20 degrees in Fort William all week long. It was sunny and warm all week long. Everyone was in t-shirts and that sort of stuff. So I said, it's definitely possible. Historically, the World Cup was like end of May leading to early June. But as I said to you earlier on, April, May are the driest months of the year in the Highlands. So it's a good time for the racing. Historically, I think July, August are just, you know, wet and warm, or just wet and cold and just cold. So it's a good time of the year for racing Fort William. Like you said, a bit of moisture always helps Fort William. And I think the chances of a few light showers are definitely still there. Even some heavy showers are still there this week. But it looks like you said, yeah, we're in for somewhat of a treat. At least I remember last year, I was actually telling my wife yesterday that I had six layers on race day last year. You know, I run cold anyway. I like hot weather, even for an Irishman. But I remember having six layers, probably race day or maybe quali day last year at Fort William. Just trying to, because I spent the whole day on the upper slopes and then, you know, at the top of the hill for warm-ups, and it's quite exposed and everything else at that mid-station. So anything that's not six layers will be a huge bonus. And even for the bikes and the riders, to be able to leave the gondola house, walk up to the start gate, drop in, and just not kind of feel that kind of tightness that the cold weather gives you for the first, you know, couple of hundred meters of riding. So I think everyone will just be even more excited to go riding and racing if the weather's good.
Definitely, man. And we've got a new schedule for 2024. So qualies and semis both together on the same day before the final, which is going to create a pretty intense long day for the athletes, and even more pressure, I guess, for those that are really on the bubble trying to get between those sessions and get into the final. What are your thoughts on that move? Because obviously it frees up the finals day and gives us more of that like one run show that we're used to, and it puts the juniors onto the big finals day as well, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. So basically you've covered it all in one sentence there. The riders, the teams, and I imagine the fans, I think the fans preferred a race run only on race day, just that build up that hype, couple of practice runs, wait around for a few hours, and everyone knows the start list. Everyone knows who's going to drop in when, the story of the week has unfolded, you're ready to go for finals. That's what everyone wanted. So Warner Brothers Discovery listened, tweaked the schedule, got the juniors back on normal race day, put the elites on just one race run on race day, which, like you said, now means we have qualies and semis back to back on quali day, let's call it day two. Which leaves us in an interesting spot, because that quali day would normally be, you do qualifying, you do your practice, do your qualifying, go for a track walk, kind of tee up your ducks for race morning to do your practice and organize whatever else. That's a big day now. That quali day is big, with an hour and a half practice, qualifying run, somewhere between 2 hours and 3 hours rest between qualies and semis, a bit less for the juniors, and then do your semis, hopefully make it to finals, and then decide whether you need to do track walk or not. And you probably will want to do track walk, but whether the body wants a 3 hour Fort William track walk is a different story. So yeah, it's a hectic day. Actual practice day, the day before that, we have 2 by 2 hour slots. So you have a 2 hour normal practice slot, and then you have 2 hours open time training, which is pretty cool. So it's, the schedule is just really good. I think we need to be totally honest about it. It's kind of similar to our previous schedule before Warner Brothers Discovery took over, slightly tweaked for the better in places. Still have semis, which some people don't like, but it is what it is for this year. The top riders especially are just used to it now. Most of them are done complaining about it. They're just going to get on with doing it. And I think as the season progresses, especially on the shorter tracks or the newer tracks like Poland, using qualies to semis is going to be an interesting kind of strategic, tactical kind of game, you know, wondering how fast you can go and not miss the cut, how much you can leave in the tank, and where the time to be gained, and all that sort of stuff. So it's going to be really interesting as the season unfolds.
Yeah. Do you think we'll see more like dad cam track walks? Are you going to be being sent up by riders to video call back, or to take evidence and bring back to them to save legs on that long day?
I mean, I've done it in the past kind of fairly extensively in different ways, whether I could ride up to a section, get the lift up, whether I'm still up there after warm-ups and can wait until the last riders go down and have a quick look. Some riders, you know, like a photo update of a section or a line or whatever else. I think the real value of a track walk is seeing it with your own eyes, getting to see it from different perspectives, from the side, from the front. Because obviously when you're coming in at high speeds and your visual search strategy is basically just to pick up the key markers in your foveal vision, so the vision in front of you, like the one that's in focus, and then that allows all the other information around that to be used in whatever way you're using it. Actually seeing it at slower speed on your own feet is of huge value. So whether we'll change anything, whether there'll be like 26 of us up there with videos and extra dad cams and VR headsets, I don't know. But yeah, it's an interesting time for the sport. And I think some people, the value of the track walk can be so big depending on how track degradation goes, depending on how your qualies and semis went. If you got absolutely smoked in some section, or if you did really well and you just kind of, you know, you have to push even more for finals if you want to win. There's so many kind of ifs and buts and ups and downs, so much individuality to it that some riders may really want to go up there regardless of the implications and fatigue. And then some of the tracks you can, obviously the last year the UCI ran the series, when Red Bull TV were still doing television, we had a huge amount of issues with back and forth of bikes are and aren't allowed trackside for track walk. And some of that was mandated by the local organizers who wanted to keep spectators safe, which is totally understood. But then they'd enforce it even when there was no spectators up there. So after practice and that sort of stuff, which is kind of understandable from a continuity perspective. But at the same time, some riders were going up the hill with bikes anyway because they had a hotel at the top of the hill, or some of the start lines are at the top of the hill anyway, like in Andorra used to be. So there was so much discrepancies and back and forth, so many arguments in all the different groups, and it created a lot of friction. Most of that's been resolved now by the new organizers. We're definitely going to have to clarify that one for, like you say, for quality day now, because everyone's going to want to take a bike up there and skid down to save the body, you know. So that'll definitely be top of the list. And actually, what they have implemented for this year is a post-track walk riders meeting. I think it's one rider from all of the UCI registered teams is invited to come and just discuss any concerns they have with Warner Brothers track team and the local organizers. So it's kind of another step in a bit of professionalization along with the press conference. So the top riders are quite busy now. They've got their normal media load, they've got press conference, they've got the post track walk meeting, they've got their actual job, which is riding bikes fast. So it's a busy week. Yeah,
again, that the importance of I guess a good engine and understanding how to do recovery well are going to be as ever, but maybe even more important this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of the ones we've discussed with some of the riders I coach, is about you kind of increasing or maintaining that engine as the season goes on, because it's all well and good coming in with a huge volume of low to moderate intensity training and potentially intervals and other stuff under the belt, and just a good density of training sessions per day, which gets the body really used to just doing a lot in a day. And that's absolutely fine, but that can decay relatively quickly once you start backing up races and travel, get a little tweak or an injury from a crash, and before you know it, you're like, oh, 5 weeks in, I've actually not done very much compared to my previous 5 weeks, you know, pre-Fort William. So I think, yeah, strategically throughout the season, that's definitely one that'll have to be discussed. I'm giving too much away now, so I need to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's talk about the fields, because I mean we're stacked everywhere. Like, every field is full of incredible talent. I mean, not that it hasn't been in the past, but it just seems to be getting topped up quicker and quicker. Let's start with junior women. Thoughts on some of the remaining second year juniors and also some of the super fast junior women that are going to be joining that category?
Yeah, well, I sent you my little list this morning of kind of rider notes of just how many amazing riders we have across the categories, and just the depth of talent and abilities we have. And I think you got the 2 pages in the PDF, and I was like, wow, we're already at 2 pages here. That's only mentioning like a handful from each category, really. So yeah, it's crazy. And in terms of the junior women, I know we've got Ellie Hulsbush, who came through. So she's from New Zealand. And she's been kind of lighting up the scoreboards last year as an under 17 rider, and now this year as a first year junior at Crankworx and other races. But it's the second year juniors that we still have, which is kind of crazy. So current world champion Reese van Leeuwen, Sasha Ernest, Poppy Lane. I think those three were on the podium last year together at World Champs in Fort William. So we've got like four or five second year juniors who are just super rapid, and you never really know how they progress, some of them between first and second year. So they grow, they mature physically and mentally quite a lot sometimes between first and second year, and they've got all that experience from the first year racing. So who knows in terms of that. And I think really what we're looking at with the junior women, we've got maybe four, five, six really, really strong riders who are not just physically, historically, sometimes you'd have a physically kind of gifted rider who just grunt their way through races and win or get on the podium. Whereas now we've just got these riders that are already, as you know, 17, 18 year old females are really, really well rounded and balanced technically and tactically and stuff. So it's an exciting time for the sport on the female side of things. And even just transferring through to the first year in elites, we've got like a serious amount of fast kind of ladies coming in, and we've only got 10 women in finals for elites, and we've got Lisa Boladu, Valentina Roa Sanchez and Amy Kenyon who are kind of adding their names to the mix for an already stacked elite women's field. So it's, yeah, it's wild times for the sport.
It is, yeah. That elite women's field is going to be incredibly competitive. I wouldn't want to be trying to get a final spot in amongst that bunch. I mean, we've got Cammy back, Miriam back, but we, I guess, a bit of a question mark over how good her thumb is at the moment for a track like Fort William. Tani back, and also on the new like prototype Canyon, I believe. Marine was on a storm at the end of last year. I saw Valley last week and she was on really good form, like had a very healthy off season, like no injuries, no niggles, been able to smash the training away. And then you've got, you know, yeah, riders like Phoebe Gale, Lisa Bauman, Gracie Hemstreet, all finding their feet in the elite field and showing what they're capable of. Like, plus threats, I guess, like, yeah, Skazi committing to downhill. That field is just, I mean, it's got to be quite intimidating trying to find a place.
Absolutely. And you missed out Nina Hoffman, who won here in 2022. Kind of veterans in the sport now, like Veronica Vidman. I mean, we've already listed off, we've probably forgotten one or two, and we haven't added in the three really fast first-year elites coming through. So we're actually at least 15 riders, maybe more. We're probably actually 18 riders that are more than capable of that, those top 10s to slot into finals. So it's literal warfare out there, like actual warfare. So yeah, crazy. And like we chatted about pre-show, you know, Marine was arguably maybe the best rider. Well, not the best, but, you know, arguably as fast, if not faster than Valley by the end of the season. Valley was obviously managing the championship and managing herself, which is exactly what she needed to do. And she won the overall and world champs. So she's the benchmark, like we said. But Marine was definitely building throughout the season to that point where she was like more than a threat for the wins. She was, you know, equal favorite by the end, in my opinion, I think. And it's so easy to forget that Marine in 2022 broke her back. So, it's like that injury, I don't think, was just discussed enough. And because Marine's relatively like quietly spoken and obviously isn't an English speaker in the beginning. So maybe harder to get some of the info out there. But that story of her kind of comeback from crashing a Leogang back in 2022 to where she is now is, yeah, she's definitely one of the ones to watch. Tan is healthy and happy, and that new bike she loves. Miriam's thumb, we don't really know exactly what the situation is there. And Campbell won that preseason race in Sandy de Vosges, Remy Tyrion's track. Didn't do the jumps in qualifying. I think she did them in finals. So she's a very clever rider. She always has been. That's one of her biggest strengths. Has been a bit of a tactical genius at times. So whether she'll play that tactical genius card as she progresses from the first race to the final race is yet to be seen. So between the young up-and-coming talent with the likes of Phoebe Gale and Gracie Hemstreet coming into their second year in elite, the kind of unknowns like Gloria Scarzi, who are, you know, a bit older but have huge room to improve, and then all of the veterans of the sport like Tani, Miriam, Marine, and now Valley, it's exciting times, yeah.
Yeah, throw Jess Blewett and Louise Ferguson in that mix as well. Like, both incredibly talented riders. Louise had a great world champs. Totally. And Jess, we've seen on the podium before. And is a dangerous rider. So,
yeah. And even like, you know, like you just said, Louise Ferguson is on the new version of the Intense Factory Racing team run by, Ollie Morris is team manager. Joe Breeden is kind of rider owner type organizer now. So that whole team is, you know, kind of the modern approach now of having a good infrastructure around the riders to support them as fully and as kind of in-depth as possible in terms of trackside support, nutrition, just the whole technical bike side of things, just everything focused on what the riders need. So yeah, it's like sky's the limit really for Louise. Jess Blewett's on Cube now. So many women have kind of transitioned to either full factory or almost full factory rides. The level of support in the women's category is huge. A lot of teams have junior women on there. A lot of teams have junior women coming up next year that they're supporting this year as under 17s. So really, I think, for the female side of the sport, it's just an amazing period to be a part of.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see with Sasha Ernest taking that full factory spot at Trek Factory Racing as well, to see what impact that like additional support can have. I know she had a bit of help from them last year, but now like under the tent kind of thing, it's going to be really interesting just to see how much of a differentiator that can be.
All those fast Kiwi girls, there's four or five of them already, and I think they'll just be, I'm not sure if they'll all practice together, but they're definitely friends, and they'll be discussing lines and life in general throughout the whole season. So that whole little kind of Kiwi crew of young female racers is just going to push each other and push the sport forward, which is really cool.
Yeah, let's talk about junior men. And I think the name that everyone's been talking about for the last year or so, it feels, is Asa Vermette, who's signed with Nico and Frameworks. Had a pretty bad injury, I think about 6 weeks back in the US. I spoke to Nico yesterday, and Asa's coming to Fort William and intends to race, which is a pretty impressive bounce back. But he's not going to get it all his own way, I think. There's some other seriously fast talent in that junior men's field, right?
Yeah, like Asa's obviously a kind of another one of this new generation of prodigies that seem to have some level of maturity, or at least riding maturity, that's unprecedented at that age type thing, which Jackson and to a point Jordan Williams have shown us, Jackson especially last year. Asa Vermette's, you know, I analyzed some of his riding when he was on course for a couple of runs in Snowshoe last year, and he was faster from A to B in a couple of sections, all by only over 12 to 15 seconds, but comfortably faster than everyone else out there. Translating that speed to consistent World Cup performances is now that's now the goal. He's got a great team around him, with Angel Suarez, his teammate, who's really used to mentoring young riders. He helped out Oisin O'Callaghan before this, and a few other riders as well. So I think having Angel as a teammate will really help him. But that junior men's category is, I think I listed out a few riders to you, and we've probably missed half of them anyway. But, you know, Tyler Waite from New Zealand on a Yeti, another one of these young Kiwi riders that's just kind of blowing onto the scene. The Alram brothers, who've been supported by Commensal now for 5 or 6 or maybe even 8 years, since they were tiny little kids. So Max and Till. Till is kind of like the halfway house between Nico Vuglio and Amaury Pierron. Just coming in off a broken wrist. So I think he'll just build throughout the season. His brother Max has historically been a little bit slower at the races, but had, you know, all the style, did the big tricks and whips. But actually in the last couple of weeks or couple of months or couple of years, I'm not exactly sure, Max has just been progressing as a racer. So I expect big things from Max. You've got Ryder Lawrence on that Intense Factory Racing team. You got Raphael Gambi on Genes. You've got Lucas Dodora, who's riding, I think, for Transition, an American kid who's kind of gone under the radar, but has put in some really fast times and all of those downhill Southeast races and some of the, you know, all of the East Coast US stuff. I think he's from Long Island or upstate New York or something, so he doesn't actually get a whole pile of good downhill. He has to travel down to, you know, North Carolina, Tennessee area to get kind of world-class downhill riding in, but he's another one. And that's what we've listed off, what, 10 maybe there? And you still got the second years like Milan Falket from Goodman Cycles. His teammate Nathan Ponvian is moving up to Elite, so he's still there. You got Christian Hauser, Lucas Lagneau on Canyon Pirelli, I think still, Dane Jewett on Pivot Factory Racing. So all these kids with support, with the knowledge, with older teammates, with endless vicarious learning through social media, watching their friends, teammates, and their idols, watching how they ride bikes and how they approach lines and tracks. And it's just the perfect storm. I think we've got the junior category is going to be just as exciting. And I think the juniors are still free to watch on YouTube, so tune in, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. And Oscar Griffiths on Intense Factory Racing. I saw some footage of him up at Fort William a week or so ago. And oh, man, like so lit, so scary to watch. But like the pace was was easily up there with the, you know, the fast elite guys.
Yeah, there's so many of these kids. Like I said, it's so easy to forget. There's so many of them. And a kid like Oscar Griffiths, who's now second year junior, I always find it a challenge actually to remember who's moving up and who's not, who's staying in juniors for another year. So we need the first race under our belts before I'll have the visual in my head. But I think, the depth of talent out there is phenomenal. And the desire, I think, to apply some sort of racecraft to the whole week and to race day for these juniors is big now. And I'm not sure if some of it comes from them, but a lot of it is just that's how the sport is now. The sport's just channels you in that direction, that your teammates and everyone is, the practice schedule is just consistently tighter and tighter than it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you had an extra day's practice from what we have now, so you could just kind of do what you want, whereas now it's quite condensed. So I think the idea of racecraft, practice strategies, tactics strategies, and all the rest is just kind of ubiquitous across the sport now, and the younger riders are just kind of, they're not pushed into it, but it just happens naturally through the environment, and here we go.
Yeah, and we've got quite a few new first-year elite men stepping up as well, and a good handful of them very dangerous for those top 30 spots.
Yeah, like 30 riders make it to finals in the elite men, and we've probably got, 10 coming through from juniors into their first-year elite that are really, really capable. Probably 5 were capable of being in the top 30 consistently, some of those in the top 10 potentially already. The likes of Ryan Pinkerton, Evan Metcalf, Henry Kiefer, who's your current world champ. Nathan Ponvien, I saw some riding. Actually, we were riding Pierron Bike Park earlier in the year, myself and Phoebe Gale and Reese Wilson. And Nathan was there for a day and it was just business. Nathan Ponvien, so he won the last World Cup in Mont Saint-Anne, if people don't know him. So there's all of these kids, you know, ones that we've kind of seen progress from being really loose to being a lot more consistent, like Ryan Pinkerton, who's definitely going to be on the money this year. To those that are kind of under the radar a little bit, like Ugo Marini, who was on Commensal Mukko for a couple of years and just his junior career didn't go as a lot of people expected, but he's on Scott now for first year elite. And I think he's going to be a more consistent dark horse as the pressure's off and he just gets to apply his kind of style of racing. Kimi Viardot, a French kid, riding a Santa Cruz, is always rapid. Kind of goes under the radar as well. So like between the high flyers who are really consistent and fast, like you're like Bodie Kuhn on Trek Factory Racing, and then the more kind of low-key racers like Nathan Ponvien and Ugo Marini and those French kids, like, yeah, it's a elite men is a hard place to be. It's a hard place to be.
Yeah, and we've got like an almost endless list of current elite men as well. I don't even know where to start. I mean, Jordan won the opening round in 2023. I think he's had a bit of an injury recently, but is back on the bike. And I feel like he learned a lot last year. Like he came under a lot of intense pressure and media attention and scrutiny after that first result, which I think probably didn't help him. But he's a smart kid, or not a kid anymore, smart man, and learned a lot moving on. He's clearly got, you know, pace to be up there at the very, very top. Be interesting to see how he's going, and also on the prototype specialized this year as well.
Yeah, so on that carbon lugged vessel, whatever it is, Finn is on the similar version to Bruni. I saw a picture of him on Instagram or somewhere with the electronic suspension like Bruni. So those guys have been putting in the off season work. Jordan won the first World Cup last year in Lenzerheide, in case people forget that one. He also won Fort William by 1/100th of a second from Jordan in 2022. And both of those guys put down, I think it was top 5 times at the time, or pretty close to it, top 6 maybe. So yeah, shame Jackson's not there. I think we could probably spend the whole podcast talking about the implications of not having Jackson at the races this year, sadly. A huge shame for the sport, because that would have been, you know, such a cornerstone of so many of the stories from the weekend. So a huge shame for him and for the sport in general, but he'll definitely be back stronger than ever. Can Jordan come out swinging? Absolutely. What Jordan needs to do to be more consistent than he was last year is really hard to know. World champs, like I remember what happened to a world champs here last year, but he was top 10 in the longest sector 2, so the main guts of Fort William with the big rocks and the sweeping corners in the exposed upper slopes. he was pretty fast up there, but then he, I don't know if he punctured or crashed further down. But, you know, that race last year for William for him at World Champs was kind of similar to the story of a lot of races where he had fast sections and sectors and then slow ones. So he's definitely still figuring things out. And I think it's just like Jackson, but different. It's just such an exciting kind of proposition for the sport. And he's got those two teammates of his, Finn and Loic, that like Loic does not want to let these kids. He's 30 years old this year, Loic. I actually saw a podcast with him yesterday. I think it's hit him at the heart that he realizes he's no longer in his 20s. he's definitely the elder statesman of the sport, but in a really good way, I think, you know, kind of like a guardsman of the sport in some respects. Still in many ways the benchmark for lots of reasons. So, and Finn is still, you know, he finished third in 2022 overall. He finished fourth last year. He needs to just figure out just some little detail in his week in, week out approach to make him, you know, more, what's the word? I think it's just to be a touch more resilient in the consistency. There's just a couple of little things. And if he does, Finn will just be, you know, unstoppable at times. So yeah, there you go. We've hit our first line in our analysis of the preseason and we're already slacking. So yeah, there's so much to talk about.
Well, and you mentioned elder statesman. Who would have expected we'd see Greg Minnaar showing up at Fort William, not on a Santa Cruz V10? He's got this new Norco program, massive change in the off-season. I'm sure he's going to be fired up for what could, I guess, potentially be his last World Cup race season. But we've probably said that a few times now, so who knows? But he goes well at Fort William. He knows how to get a bike set up. I'm guessing he's been motivated and maybe spending more time on a downhill bike than usual off seasons. It's going to be fascinating to see how he goes, but also how that whole team gets on, actually, with him being so heavily involved.
Yeah, there's, like, what can you say about Greg Minnaar? All the superlatives, the legend of all legends, the GOAT himself. What's really interesting is actually the team infrastructure and the approach that they're taking. So they're spending some big money, obviously, Norco. Where the cash is coming from, I'd love to know, because they've got a lot of staff. I saw a picture actually on social media a couple of days ago with, you know, picture of the whole team, riders, mechanics, trackside staff, physios, the whole lot. They've got a lot of staff, which is kind of your standard approach now at World Cups. And I do remember talking to Greg probably 5 years ago now. And, you know, because I was out there trackside every session and knowing Greg for years from the races, and we were talking about the direction the sport's going. And, you know, he's always got his eye on what the younger riders are doing and the direction the sport's progressing. And he's kind of like, I think I've said it before somewhere, he's like the Madonna of downhill. He just wants to reinvent himself when necessary, because I think he knows how important it is to get ahead of the curve at times, especially as you age physically like he is. And I think he's seen that. So this opportunity that he's kind of taken or crafted or been thrust upon him, and he's, you know, taken it with open arms with redeveloping the Norco program, it's just really interesting. And I think beyond the bike, beyond the craziness of leaving Santa Cruz, just having the ability to craft this infrastructure around himself and the other riders, where they're definitely putting a big emphasis on trackside support and analysis. And like we spoke about on a preseason podcast a couple of years ago, we spoke about, or my hunch was that the sport is going to go in the direction of having an engineer and potentially having engineers at the races to deal with data acquisition, to deal with like liaising with like the technical director who might be the head mechanic or whatever, and working in that more motorsport direction at times, but in a unique way for downhill. And that's exactly what it looks like Norco are trying to do, and other teams are doing it already low key. I know the new Mondraker team is also kind of attempting that approach. So we talked about it a couple of years ago, so we'd have to dig that podcast out and give ourselves a pat on the back. But that looks like how things are going. And it's really cool for the sport to see that when a rider like Greg, who's been around literally forever, he's twice the age of some of the juniors we just talked about, or more, which is crazy. You know, he's actually more than twice the age of a lot of the racers he'll be lining up against. And he's seen how the sport's changing and progressing. He's also been in a place where technical support of certain types has come and gone from his Honda days to his Santa Cruz days. And I think it's just really cool to see that Greg's taken that bigger picture view of how you win races and helped craft a team of people around him, which will also be around, you know, Gracie Hemstreet and Lucas Cruz, to go try and win races. So it's cool for the sport.
It is, definitely. Looking at your notes, you wrote, Ethan Craik, is he the man to beat? I wouldn't argue with that personally, given what I've seen of Ethan over the last year or two. Give us your interpretation of what you've seen in Ethan that you think makes him, you know, one of those people to be watching out for.
I think it's, yeah, there's a couple of things with Ethan Craig. Obviously, he won Mont Sedan last year, season last year. He dominated this preseason race in Portugal, which had a lot of the top 10 men at it, including Finn, Loic, and plenty of others. He consistently beat everyone qualies and finals there by quite a few seconds in a very short track, which was interesting on a new bike for him. So he's on Scott now, not on GT anymore. I know his mechanic, Rich Simpson, who you know very well, will be a key part in Ethan's progress and success. I think that consistency. But Ethan's just, he's a quiet guy, a quiet kid. And I think if you go through his progression in terms of like race results and numbers, and also just his maturing as a racer and maturing physically, he's on that gentle trajectory that is sustainable. So like high persistent performance becomes sustainable if the trajectory is quite stable, where sometimes you have these big ups and downs of riders and they get kind of a bit lost, like, oh, I won qualifying, what do I replicate to replicate that, you know? Whereas Ethan has just slowly creeped his way up there, so he's definitely a danger man. I think when a rider has that stable support structure around them, has a strong race approach, strategic or tactical approach, whatever you want to call it, and has slowly progressed in all the different facets that make a good racer, they're definitely dangerous, you know? It just becomes way more sustainable. So definitely, I'm just excited for the sport to see how Ethan does, because he'd just be potentially another top five guy consistently. So yeah.
Yeah, he didn't win Mont Sedan though. You've forgotten about Jackson, because Jackson was so far ahead of everyone. He was like 4 seconds
sorry,
up.
Sorry, yeah, yeah. So totally forgot. Jackson dominated Mont Sedan, dominated Mont Sedan to the point where he's in his own category. And I thought Ethan won it. Ethan got second in Mont Sedan, didn't he? Crazy.
But even Ethan was a couple of seconds ahead of everyone else, right?
Yeah. I can't remember how it all laid out. It was such a whirlwind, that event. But yeah, Ethan dominated one of the sectors for sure. It was so far ahead of everyone else. And then Jackson just came down and literally like annihilated the entire field, really. Yeah, so by a margin that shouldn't be allowed, really. But yeah, honestly, I think, yeah, Ethan's just on the trajectory, on the right path for sure. And do we need to say it again? What a shame Jackson's not here, you know?
Massive shame. Let's talk Mondraker, another team that have shaken the money tree and come up good. That team is stacked, and I'm fairly convinced they're going to turn up with a lot of infrastructure too.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah, so it's Jorge Garcia's team manager. He used to be technical delegate for the UCI. He took over from David Vasquez. So he's who we kind of liaised with on track safety and course safety building and all that sort of thing at the World Cups for many seasons. Now he works for Mondraker, so he's kind of implemented this, spent an entire season, if not more, kind of slowly but surely crafting the infrastructure and signing the riders to this team. So we got Dakota Norton, whose stocks have just been progressively going up over the last few seasons. Looks like he's gelled extremely well with the new Mondraker, judging by preseason performance. Ryan Pinkerton as well, who's just, you know, maturing as a racer, doing exceptionally well. So I think that entire... Yeah, it's like you said, the money tree, they've shook it, they've come up trumps, they're stacked with cash when other teams and the industry isn't, which is, it's cool for the sport to see that people are, you know, a well-known established brand like Mondraker to see huge value in downhill. So that's really, really nice to see. And I'm just excited to see exactly how it all plays out, you know?
Yeah. And Amri Piron back. I mean, that was a hell of an injury, a big one to recover from, basically a whole season out and potentially... Yeah. You know, some niggles, I'm sure, from that when he's back on the bike. But we should never look beyond Amri Piron, right? Incredible, strong, committed rider to watch. Do you think we'll see big things from Amri this season? It's going to be quite an ask, I think, to jump back in.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Like, he's had some major trauma previously. COVID year, had the spleen issue, had another huge crash after that. I can't remember what the injury was, but he basically had two huge ones back to back, missed the majority of a couple of seasons, but was always able to come back in those seasons and kind of get a taste for racing again and you know, try his best to battle for the wins. This was the complete season out last year, so slightly different ask, but he came in 2022 after a very up and down 2021 season and won Lourdes in emphatic fashion, one of the most exciting race runs we've ever seen in Lourdes. With probably the most views of a race from GoPro ever. If you check out the Red Bull TV or GoPro YouTube pages, you see Amory's 2022 GoPro run. Of all the people who are capable of, you know, coming out still in the top 10, in the top 5, it's that guy. He's been pretty quiet this offseason in terms of social media presence, which to me just means he's been chipping away at the work. Whether he's had any other setbacks or whether, you know, the neck injury has caused any necessary changes in bike shape, bike setup, riding style or riding preferences, I don't know. I think he's got an entire season to build if need be, but if anyone can come out at the sharp end, it's that guy, you know?
Definitely. And another returning rider, Reese Wilson, always an exciting rider to watch. He's a rider that I've missed on track over the last year or so. Creative, got a lot of flair to the way he rides. I'm guessing the sensible thing to do is to ease your way back into racing, but it's his home race. He's gone well there in the past and he's been off racing for a long time. Like, I know you're close to Reese, you work with Reese. What do we know about where Reese is at and how he's feeling about coming back to World Cup racing?
He's extremely excited. He's in a very happy place with his riding at the moment. He's riding extremely well. His training has been, you know, heavily modified and very much kind of rider led and a lot of riding as the focus, because up until recently, you know, your classic kind of heavy physical training was still causing a lot of pain. In those injuries, the injury he had was extreme, to say the least. So Reese's approach to coming back to racing, I think, is just going to be building one race at a time. It's been a long, long time. He raced Val d'Isola last year, missed out on qualifying by one spot, which in the end he was happy about because of how wild that track was. Because at that stage the leg wasn't strong enough. But I think at that stage last year he didn't want to, you know, miss out on, you know, riding at least one or two World Cup tracks throughout the season. So he's in a way better place now physically. Tactically, mentally, the whole lot. So I think it's just a case of building. He doesn't have huge expectations on himself. He just wants to be healthy and happy racing his bike. So that's the number one focus for now. And like you said, he's probably one of the most interesting and exciting riders to watch. So for the fans, for the media to watch Reese again out on track, to get to see his fluidity, his style, his creativity, all of those things, it's just like one of the nicest things out there to watch. It's like a classic painting on track. You know, it's amazing to see. So to have him back healthy and hopefully just building strength on strength each race is exactly what we need, what the sport needs, what he wants. So that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah. And another artist on a bike, Loris Vergier, had a great season last year, but it wasn't quite to be in that battle with Loic for the overall. He also is very thorough, I believe, in his approach. Like, him and his mechanic PA works super hard in the off season and during the season on having everything they need, and are very specific about setup and shock tunes and spoke tension and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't know until recently, but Loris has a new prototype under wrap Trek bike available to him this season, which he seems pretty happy with. Do you think we'll finally see the season that Loris Vergier is capable of, like, putting together?
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? I think maybe the same podcast you and I did a few years ago, talking about the potential that, you know, teams will start to have engineers at the races, and the whole infrastructure of the teams is going to be one of the big things as the sport progresses. We definitely chatted about this, the whole medium pivot idea, like high pivots were going to come in after the success of the Commensal V4, whatever it was, with Amery. And that people were going to, you know, replicate that and then realize that it was probably too much of a compromise and then kind of go to something a bit more in between. And that's probably what Trek are aiming for with this one, slightly less high of a pivot potentially than the current bike, different frame construction. So yeah, Loris, like you said, is the ultimate tweaker, loves to tinker and tweak, maybe to his own detriment at times, I'm not sure. But probably in terms of raw pace, the fastest or one of the top three fastest guys out there. And so consistent, even though with a couple of issues and errors and mistakes last year, like, he's just always there or thereabouts. So really exciting to see. And if, as he did previously for a couple of races, that Maribor victory in 2021, I think it was, you know, stunning in those really, really dry, hot conditions. If Loris gets himself into a role and is in a happy place with the bike, with the setup, physically, all of those things, nothing's unstoppable, but that boy is something else in terms of his riding. And, you know, equally as interesting to watch as Reese Wilson, but just very, very different in terms of how they actually ride. But that light touch, that fluidity, that ability to place the wheels exactly where he wants them to be, the ability to carry speed without it looking aggressive, like, it's, yeah, we're, as a sport, we're in for, so, we, we're in for such a treat this season, as we have been in previous seasons. So many unique riders with unique riding styles and kind of movement signatures on the bike. So Lauris is just another one that's so different to his competitors, and yet hits the finish line, you know, within 0.2 of a second of everyone else.
Yeah, there's no way we're going to mention everyone today because we'd be here all morning, I think. But a few more names to throw out there. Benoit Coulonge coming off his first win last season and also taking a win in the preseason, again, beating Loic, which has got to be a good confidence boost. Andreas Kolb, I think, back healthy and riding at pace after an early season injury in New Zealand, but again, had a great run through the last World Cup season. And then Laurie Greenland had some incredible results last year, given that he was battling some kind of ongoing illness throughout the season, which I believe he's healthy and ready to go. Another three riders that could easily be on the podium or on the top spot any given weekend, I think.
Yeah, I like Kolb, huge danger man, could win every race pretty much, understated. Relatively clinical, super fast, probably should have won World Champs last year if his run had gone a bit more in his, should have won World Champs comfortably last year if the run had gone a bit more his way, but he made a mistake, so that's on him. Definitely one of the men to watch this week. Same as Benoit Coulonge, was really strong here in 2022, only lost a race by a small margin. Kind of the journeyman workman, loves to work hard, so physicality is not his problem, and also loves to dissect a racetrack and try and figure out how to eke out every margin, every millisecond. So he'll definitely be one to watch. Danny Hart should have won Fort William 10 times, has never won it on his new bike. Yeah. Will be really interesting to see how he gels with that new bike, whether that new bike was obviously proven effective last year under Pinkerton and Ethan Craig. So whether that bike gives him a little edge that he needs to get back up there, we don't know. Like you said, too many people to talk about. And so many riders that were, you know, on that bubble last year, say 30 to 20, that may have found something during the off season or may have just matured with their racing and could be right up there. And we, you know, most people, some of the names people won't even know regularly, you know, only the hardcore fans will know some of the names. So it is the most stacked first World Cup in a long time. And for now, fingers crossed, with the exception of Jackson, who we'll mention again, there's no major preseason injuries, you know. No high-profile ones as yet, so it's an exciting time.
It is, yeah. Well, let's mention the world champion, Charlie Hatton. He didn't get to spend a huge amount of time in his stripes last year before he picked up that wrist injury. Wrists can often be a bit tricky to kind of recover and get comfortable on the bike again, but I've seen him riding. Looks like he's back up to pace and clearly a massive threat in Fort William. He's qualified well there in the past. He's won world champs there. Will we see Charlie's first World Cup win?
Yeah, definitely possibly. He was 15th in 2022, I think, if I remember correctly. And he's some really fast sectors. The main sector, Sector 2, the big open rocky stuff near the top. He was really fast in 2022, dominated there last year, hence why he won World Champs. Can he get his first World Cup win? Absolutely. Most certainly can. He's got the bike, the maturity, the experience, the physicality. He's got all of the different pieces. The wrist injury, obviously, is, you know, him and Oli Zwaar actually picked up a real similar injury at the same time, and both of them are probably in a similar spot in that it's very normal doing certain things, and then the metal work in such a tight and delicate area with so many small bones can cause a lot of issues, a lot of irritation, and it just takes a little tweak or a funny crash or an awkward hit at World Cup paces for those injuries to get a little bit sore. So I think it's just a management case, and Charlie's, yeah, he'll be stoked to get out there in the rainbow stripes at home on the track he won World Champs on, first World Cup of the season. I think the dude will just be, he'll be smiling ear to ear no matter what, you know.
Yeah, and one more late team move before we wrap up. Ollie Davis onto Santa Cruz Syndicate, sitting in Jackson Goldston's pit spot. He's familiar with that bike, you know, he rode it on the Union and rode super well on it. Again, a pretty kind of low-key guy that now has some of the biggest support on the circuit. He's going to be thrust in front of the media as a result of that, which I guess brings its own pressures. But another talented rider with a huge amount of support to see how he gets on is going to be another interesting one.
Yeah, is this his first time on that new generation V10, though? I think those guys rode the old one last year for the whole season, I think. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they did. They rode the older one. But that's only details, really. I think, like you said, the support, the infrastructure, kind of taking Jackson's mechanic and Jackson's seat for now. is going to be amazing for Ollie. I think the whole syndicate team and vibe will definitely work for him. He knows everyone there already. They would have helped each other out in different ways, whether it's logistically or trackside support, Steve, because it was previously a Santa Cruz team on the Union. So I think he's just going to, go from strength to strength, and that fluid, relax. He's actually got one of the most unique styles in the World Cup circuit. Like when Jackson and Laurie were coming down together in the Red Bull helmet, from a certain distance, you were like, ooh, who's who? And it was only when they got a little bit closer that you could pick out that Jackson maybe had slightly longer limbs in some way, and you could see, oh, that's Jackson, not Laurie. With Ollie, he's got this such a unique style that actually we'll be able to, well, minus the Red Bull helmet is anyway, but he's so unique that I think seeing him in that team, the exposure he's going to get is going to be really cool for him. And last year, he didn't qualify. Fair and square, did not qualify at Lenzerheide, and then just went from strength to strength as the season went on. Kind of, I don't know if he rode himself into speed or rode himself into specific fitness or whatever it was, but he just went from strength to strength as the season went on. So if he can continue that, then I'm excited for him.
Yeah, I'm excited for the entire season. I can't wait to get racing. Luckily, it's a local race for us, so I'll be trackside watching, which will be great. So yeah, I guess I will see you on the hill in a couple of days' time, and we finally get to go World Cup racing again.
Yeah, I'm excited. Finally, get out of the dungeon, get back trackside, get a suntan, hopefully.
Nice one. I shall see you there, mate.
All right, cool. See you, Trax. Bring coffee, please.
Will do. All right, that's it for this Max's Tyres pre-race show with Chris. I hope you're as excited as we are for racing to kick off in style this weekend. Massive thanks to Maxis for supporting this season. I really couldn't do these shows without them. Maxis have incredible tyres for you no matter how or where you ride, so head over to maxis.com or visit your local Maxis dealer to check them out. Here's a few other links that might be useful to you too. If you want to help support the podcast, that could be via a regular donation at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, by grabbing yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop, by sharing the episodes with your friends or online, or by subscribing to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast and sharing the video some love with likes and comments to help the channel grow. You can follow the podcast by hitting that button in your podcast app now, and over on Instagram and Facebook where we're at Downtime Podcast. You can also get an extra dose of downtime by signing up to our newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. As always, spread the word and make sure as many people as possible are listening. All right, that's it for today. But until next time, get out and ride.